welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Turn the Page. I'm your host today, Jen, and I'm here with the creators of a fantastic new graphic novel that is out today, the day that we are recording. By the time you hear this, it will be well out in the world. So let's get right into it. Could I ask you to introduce yourselves, please?
Oh, Bob, I was going to say Bob should go first. Hi,
I'm
Christopher Painter. I'm the writer and co-creator of Black Cat Social Club.
And I am Bob Quinn. I am the artist and co-creator of Black Cat Social Club. And I also draw a bunch of other comics as well that you might have heard of, like X-Men and stuff.
And things.
Yeah. This is such a fun book. Such a fun book. I had so much fun reading it. And I've already told all of my comics reading friends to pick it up because it was just like a fantastic little journey. Could I ask you about how this book came to be? Have you worked together before? Is this your first collaboration? Like, how did you come to this project?
It was the first collaboration in like a comic setting. Krista and I used to work together in the corporate world. Oh. Yeah, so like way back in the day, I used to be a video game producer. So like I was like I didn't have the cool job where you sit down like a computer and actually make the thing work. I used to have like the lame job where I'd call somebody up on the phone and go, "Why doesn't this work? Make it work better," and hang up the phone and be real mad at him. But Chris and I work together. Can we say the place? Would we get in trouble, Chris?
I don't think so. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. We worked at Disney together. So, I think what happened was, is I drew a picture of a bunch of the main characters. And then Chris, you wrote to me on like Instagram or Facebook or something. You're like, yeah. I love these. I want to write this book. And I was like, all right, let's sit down and talk about it. So
that was exactly, yeah.
And then that's how we did.
I follow Bob on Instagram, as everyone should. Master on Instagram. I follow Bob, and I always looked at all of his stuff, and I was like, I hate it so much because I love it, and I just want to work on something with him, and it makes me so mad that I'm not. And so he had one thing that he posted one time that were these pictures of these three that were labeled as punk rock witches. And I looked at them and I wrote a comment and I said, I would totally write this book. and Bob wrote back and said, I would totally draw this book. And so that was how hard it was.
Wow. Real hard. You overcame trials and tribulations to work together. So congratulations on that. That's great.
Yeah, thanks. It was a real struggle, but it, you know, having overcome it makes this victory of having the book out so much sweeter.
We've got plenty of stories about tales of woe and adversity. So this was a nice, refreshing change of pace about how much fun it was to work with Bob and how easy it was to sort of gel the project. Because we, you know, if you pitch a project, sometimes it's like, well, I've got one vision for it and they've got another vision for it. And our vision was just like so perfectly aligned because our senses of humor are sort of exactly the same and the kind of tone that we like is the same. And that's the sort of thing that's hard to nail down, is like, what, you know, how funny do you want it to be versus how action, fantasy, sci-fi do you want it to be? And it was sort of like exactly that we both wanted exactly the same mix of that.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. It's a great mix, I think, you know, because the characters and the relationships feel like very real, you know, like, but it takes place like in this like extremely zany world, like going through like a very zany sort of apocalypse. Can you talk a little bit about our witch rock and roll superstar heroes that are at the center of this book? Because the three main characters are so great. They have such a great dynamic. And I just would love if you could talk a little bit about, because it sounds like you sort of came up with the designs first. So I'm wondering, like, how did their personalities kind of emanate from there? How did that come together?
Bob?
I actually, well, I mean, the the designs of I can mostly speak to the designs of the characters, right? Because they were based off of like just people in the rock and roll world that I liked. So like the main character is sort of based on Alice is sort of based on Brody from the Distillers, and then like Hazel is based on this girl I knew that played bass for somebody in LA that I thought she was an amazing bassist, and I always thought she was really good. She had awesome stage presence. And then Maggie was sort of based on Kim Shattuck from the Muffs. And that's just kind of, you know, that's just sort of the inspiration for those characters visually. But I drew them. And then when Chris came back with his outline, he had fleshed out like who they were, which I'd never even thought about when I was drawing them. I was just like, I don't know, they look neat.
but that's how good the drawings were, was that when you saw them, you were like, oh, I can totally see like what her whole history is, and what brought her to this point, and what does she want, and what are her needs and desires, and what, you know, what does she find appealing, and what does she hate, you know, that kind of thing. Like, it was looking at the characters, you can see sort of the personalities came through in the images. And so, you know, for a 120 page book, it has to have like a, you know, everybody has to sort of have, you need each character to have their own sort of small arc. And then you need the bigger arc of the characters. Then you need the bigger arc of the story. You know what I mean? So it's like, just for sort of plugging those into those particular, you know, spaces, you know, what, obviously it has to be about Alice because it's her band. So we wanted her to have the main arc of the story. And the others, you know, are important members as well. So they needed to have their own, you know, full circle stories. And then we wanted to give like the demons something fun to be doing on a project, and I loved all of the demon offices that are just like these drab cubicles, which sort of look like exactly how you might imagine it to look.
Yeah, I love like hell as an office, like this, just like, because it's makes the most sense. Like, it just absolutely makes the most sense. It has quotas and, you know, all this stuff,
layer upon layer of middle management.
Yes. Yeah. Like, we will all be doing paperwork forever, you know, in hell, I guess. And I really love, yeah, the way that like this sort of like office comedy kind of like, you know, jams up against this like rock band story. It's a lot of fun. And I love how like the plot like begins in a way that's like really rooted in the characters and who they are, because it's really like all starts with sort of like Hazel's insecurity and Alice's sort of like maybe like slightly aggressive leadership sometimes, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about you know, telling these two stories side by side, and sort of like, how do you determine like when it's time to switch from one to another, and how do you like balance the pacing of two stories that eventually come together?
Yeah, good question. You know, it was important to start off right away with sort of like a problem. And so like the problem sort of shows up on page two. I don't like stories that take a long time for me to figure out like, okay, what is this about? Why am I watching this? So we put the problem up front, which was that, you know, Hazel felt like, you know, she's the youngest member. She's not as powerful of a songcaster as the others. And so, you know, if you're a part of a group and you have the least amount of power in it, you're going to want more so that you can impress your friends and not let them down. So, you know, she goes about it in a very bad way by selling her soul for more power. And so then, of course, it just naturally follows that if Alice is the protective one of this, you know, sister-like band, and she feels, you know, she feels very protective of everyone in it, she's going to say, okay, I'll take on the debt myself. And so then that sort of is like the act one, right? If we sort of thought of this in terms of like movie pacing, because it felt like, you know, it felt cinematic to me. That's usually how I write most of my stuff. Mm. And so, yeah. And in terms of like balancing which one to trade off, you know, when to trade off to another story, like I said, it's always Alice's story. So it's sort of like, you know, all of the things that happened to everybody, the other band members, the demons, the father, all of this stuff is sort of funneled through like, what's Alice's reaction to it? What is she doing? What is she doing about it? When she messes up, how does she try to make it right? All of those sort of considerations.
The story is just so much fun. And I'd love if we could talk a little bit about too, the apocalypse kind of at the center of this.
Spoilers.
Yeah, sorry. It is in the subtitle, but you know, I guess if you didn't read that far, you could. It could be a spoiler. Yeah. Could we talk a little bit about like the monsters and the demons that populate hell? Because like the office drone characters, let's say, they're all really fun and it feels like a workplace comedy in a lot of ways. But then like when, you know, like the hell stuff really starts popping off, we have like a lot of really fun, like demonic monsters too. So could you talk a little bit about like writing demons and drawing demons like together?
Yeah. So it started because I was like, oh man, I want to see Bob draw some really great monsters. And so I was like, okay, how can we get the story to the point where Bob is drawing like really awesome monsters? The sketches of Peter and Bastion and Stan were all part of the original sort of suite of characters that Bob sketched up. So those were all sort of like, you know, those all were part of it from the very beginning. I mean, they look almost exactly the same as when he first sketched them. So the office workers all sort of looked, you know, very, very much like they do now. And just for all the monsters, you know, we just said these have to be monsters that look like they're capable of completely obliterating the entire world. And okay, go. And I think the script, that I wrote would have things like, this page has a giant monster destroying stuff. Good luck.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's actually pretty accurate. Yeah, no, I think the only thing that changed about the demon office drone guys was that, like, I think Bastion's head got smaller from the original sketches, and then Stan got progressively stupider and stupider as the book went on, until I finally got to. There's one panel at the end of the book, which I think is the greatest panel, which is where he just says, oh, neat. And it's like his eyeballs are going in the wrong direction. It's just like it just delights me to no end. But yeah, thank you, Chris, for giving me such for helping me shape them much farther than I had originally done in my head. And then as far as the monsters, yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things where once you just sort of let the imagination start to expand and play, you kind of just start going, okay, what would be gross? All right, well, normal human mouths go sideways. So what if this one's vertical with way too many teeth? Okay, that looks disgusting. And then, all right, well, what if bodies need to be more amorphous because that makes me it becomes an exercise of what makes me sort of uncomfortable. And then once I'm there, you push it a little bit farther until you go, okay, yeah, that's
it. Was all deep psychological probes of Bob. You could really like look at the monsters and say, like, what does Bob find disturbing?
Yeah, and they gross me out.
Yeah, there's a lot of really gross ones there, and like a lot of really like kind of cute ones too, though. Like, so,
yeah, like,
I don't know what that says about me, you know. But well, we can like, I'll ask my therapist later. But you know. I just like, I'd also love to talk about panel composition too, because there are some that are just like so striking. There's like one that I really loved where Can I talk about this without spoiling something? I'll cut this if you like, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Let's go.
Okay. There's a scene where, like, when Alice is escaping from the office, you know, and you kind of have her like running down the hallway. And like it's a top down shot, kind of. Oh, right. And then, like, she's escaping from like a hell office, which is a hell office party, which is like, like every office party is already hell. So, like...
That's what makes me uncomfortable. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was for Chris.
And yeah, I just like, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about like composing like action or dynamic panels like that versus like conversation type panels, you know, because like suggesting movement with a static image is like, I guess, a thing that comic artists have to do all the time. But like, what are your strategies for that?
So there's a bunch of things that you actually have to keep in mind when you're trying to compose a page, and then like making them all work harmoniously is really the struggle of the job, honestly. So the first thing that you're trying to do is create an overall composition for the page that nicely guides your reader's eye from one panel to the next in a way that makes sense. And sometimes I do a great job of it. Sometimes I go, well, this looks cool, and if it doesn't guide you perfectly, we're okay. So like, you know, in some cases you'll do, all right, if I do a shot from sort of top down where we have a leg way extending, the leg should kind of maybe point us towards the focal point of the next panel. And then this one will have an arm that kind of points in the direction of the next panel that we're supposed to look at. And then once you kind of have that flow arranged, the next big thing is making sure. So as you very astutely pointed out, we don't have actual motion, right? Like these are a series of still images. So it's incumbent upon me to make sure that I'm communicating the motion and action of whatever's going on in that panel to its fullest extent, right? And the best way to do that is it's an oldie but goldie. If you look at the old drawing comics the Marvel way, they say what you should always do is take the most extreme position of any potential action that you have, right? So if you're winding up for a punch, you are leaning so far back that it looks like maybe you're off balance. And when you finally throw the punch, your arm has extended far beyond what your human body should be able to do. Your entire torso has twisted, right? Like you're trying to communicate the most extreme version of that pose. Because again, like, you know, you don't have all those little in-betweens of like actually seeing the arm go through. So you have to, and it also helps communicate how powerful the thing is too, right? Like the more, like in that panel, like I stretch Alice's leg out really, really, really far, right? And that's all just trying to communicate how, like, it's partially to communicate that like she's going down a weird hallway that's sort of like otherworldly. It's also to communicate that she's running as fast as she possibly can, right? So it's like all that stuff kind of works together to create this panel where her leg just is super long.
That's so cool. And I love what you said too about like the flow of a page, because that's something that I think about a lot when I'm reading. And there is like a sort of beautiful tragedy there that like, if you do it really well, like guide the reader, you know, through like how their eye should flow over the page. Like I imagine that takes a really long time, but if you do it really well, they're kind of reading it seamlessly, effortlessly, and it's kind of like invisible, right? Like it's
yeah. Like if I've done my job right, you don't notice me.
Yeah. It's like eyebrows, you know.
Yeah.
That was a master class in comic book drawing, by the way.
Yeah, that's all super useful.
Hey, you get it for free on this podcast. Tune
that's
in
right.
Next week.
Right? Yeah.
All of that was so true and so good.
It was, yeah. I love how it all works together. And something that I really appreciated while we're talking about educating people is that you included the pitch doc at the end of the comic. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because I've pitched things and I have friends who have pitched things, and a really good pitch document is like a really hard thing to do. So I would love to, if you could talk a little bit about like, why you included it and what you hope readers get out of it, perhaps.
Well, I would note very briefly that that is only a fraction of the pitch document. The pitch document that we sent to them was huge. It depends, right? So from company to company that you might be sending a potential pitch document to will have different requirements. And I know, at least from our point, we just kind of I made sure that we included, from a visual perspective, basically everything that I've ever seen a publisher ask for. So it's like, it had drawings of each one of the characters. It had little expression sheets of them. But then we also went on to expand and actually talk about a ton of other stuff. So like, originally I had a friend do us up a logo that was sort of, isn't the one that we ended up going with for the actual book, but like, he went in and did a logo for us. We did an overview of sort of what the whole thing was going to be. We talked about the band, the characters. We actually spent multiple pages in there kind of talking about how magic works within the world. Talked about demons, drew all of those up, and then had multiple pages on the story, and then had a bunch of sample pages in it. It might have been like 20 pages or something that we sent. It was huge.
Yeah. Yeah. It was everything except writing the file. You know, it was everything except the finished product, basically. It was to basically, like, you know, if you're an editor, you're looking for the confidence that you have as an editor that if you like a pitch and you buy it, that the folks who are pitching it can follow through on everything that is in it and every promise that is made. We just wanted to pack as much into it as we could. And at this point, we didn't know if it was going to be a full graphic novel like it ended up being, or if it was going to be traditional, you know, 20 page comics that come out, you know, once a month. We didn't know. We had no idea if anyone would buy it or who the, you know, just nothing. So it was sort of, we had just sort of broad strokes for all of these things. And the end result of the 120-page book wound up being like our favorite pitches from the 20-page books, sort of all strung together as if you were binge watching like a six episode series.
Because I think originally we'd pitched it as like, hey, this is a 200-page thing, and there's actually a few things that were in the original outline that we really liked that sort of ended up on the proverbial cutting room floor, which was sort of, you know, obviously a little sad, but you know, you got to make these trade-offs in order to get the thing done on time. So,
and you might have a great idea for something, and you're like, oh, you fall in love with this idea. This is the best idea ever. And then as you're putting the whole project together, you look at it and go, oh no, this doesn't fit anywhere. If I shoehorn it in, it's going to be so weird. And so you just have to say, oh, I love this idea so much, but it doesn't have a place here. So you put it in the file and you use it for next time.
Yeah, you use it for the inevitable sequel.
Well, I'm glad to hear that a sequel is inevitable, because I would love to spend more time with characters.
Me too. Please tell somebody else that it's inevitable. Maybe it'll actually happen.
I know. If enough people think it's inevitable, then maybe nobody can stop it.
Yeah, we'll manifest this. We can do it.
Right.
Love it.
I'll make a vision board.
One more question before we go. I would love to talk a little bit about the music that is featured in this, because one thing I love that I'm also fascinated with is like textually suggesting music, and all the songs that you've written have really great lyrics. And I was wondering, like, when you are writing songs for a piece like this, do they have melodies in your head, or are you just writing lyrics, or like, how far into imagining this music have you gone?
I could hum all these songs for you and how they appeared in my mind. You know, they all have to serve a purpose in the story. So, you know, if you look at the lyrics, they are obliquely in some way referring to something that the band is trying to accomplish with their song spell, because the song spells, you know, the song spells take magic and shape it with lyrics into what they want the effect to be, right? And so for all of the songs, there's a sense of, like, you know, what are they trying to accomplish with this song, whether it's a summon crowd or whether it's a, you know, if they're entertaining people, if they, you know, that sort of thing. It's like everything, if they're calling up, you know, one of the demons from hell, it all has to have, you know, the lyrics all have to sort of work towards those things. Mm-hmm. So I would write them up with that in mind, knowing that they had to accomplish something. I would have sort of a general sense of what the melody was in my head and use that for the pacing of the, you know, for the cadence of the lyrics. And as you're reading it, you would probably, if you have my melody, that's great. If you have your own, that's great. It, you know, it works anyway, which is the nice thing about putting lyrics on a page with no music, is you can interpret it like you want. And then our letterer, Haas, did a fantastic job visually interpreting what these lyrics and songs look like. And then paired with Bob, sort of like showing what a song. I told Bob one of the things when we first started was, I would love for this book to show what a song sounds like. And he took it and ran with it, and all, you know, did that for all the songs, and they look terrific.
Yeah. So Haas is a guy that I've worked with in the past. The first book that we did together was Old Lone Ranger that we did for Dynamite Comics. And when we were pitching this and we were trying to assemble the rest of the team, I told Humanoids, I was like, there's only one person I want lettering this book. Because Haas takes chances with lettering in ways that a lot of other letterers in the industry don't. And will just and finds real interesting ways to sort of heighten whatever is going on in the story. And I see a lot of people kind of like, all right, well, he's gone a little overboard in this sense, so let's pull him back a little bit. And with this book, I was just like, I don't want to stop him from doing anything he wants to do. I'm not going to give him any notes on the way that he wants to show us how these words are being sung or whatever is being. I'm just going to let him off his leash and see what he does. And I feel like we were rewarded greatly by just kind of letting him play. And then as far as the music goes, we actually released a trailer for the book a little while back. And the music that is in the trailer is actually one of the songs from the book. I did write it. Like the music does exist.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
I actually hired somebody off of Fiverr to sing it. And she's got a fantastic voice. She's a little Croatian, so it's so, you know, I don't know if that'll ever see the light of day, but to me it all exists.
Yeah, and also Bob is a musician as well. And so he brought a musician's knowledge of, how everything is set up on a stage, what the backstage looks like when you're hauling your equipment out to the van out back. Like, what does that look like? You know what I mean?
All
like,
stuff that's I've all, done.
I know all stuff Bob has done. And so, I would say, you know, I would just like write whatever I wanted to. And Bob would say, well, actually, like, I don't know that you would have this at this particular venue. And I'm like, oh, okay. Thanks, Bob. And so then we change it to whatever it was supposed to be.
I received a very, very kind, compliment from a good artist friend of mine who said that, this is the first time he's actually seen somebody accurately draw the thrill of playing live music on stage, and that meant quite a bit to me. So that was yeah. Very nice.
Yeah, it takes someone who really knows what it's like to play on a stage to capture that, and it really shows that Bob knows his stuff.
Absolutely. And I think it really does a great job of capturing that. Like, this might seem super obvious now that I'm saying it out loud, but that, like, music is a kind of magic, you know, like, and like you're making nothing, and like you are like, it makes it very like, I don't know, like, yeah, I would sell my soul for that, like, for that experience. Like, absolutely. Well,
she said it on air, everyone. Yeah.
I've played to enough empty rooms in LA for about a decade. Like, I understand these feelings. I'm like, yeah, just give it to me. I just put somebody out there, please.
But yeah, it's true that Matt, you know, music, it's not the thing, one of the things that makes this book, even though it's fantastical, makes it a little believable is the idea that, you know, what you said is that music is magic. So it's not a big jump to say that it's actual magic because, you know, music has a big effect on people. And so if you just gave it a little nudge of saying, well, no, it is real magic. It's easy for people to buy that premise. So it's not something that you have to realize. I just can't wrap my mind around. Music is magic. What? So, you know, it you're off to the races with an easy sell that people can wrap their heads around. And then you can progress to giant monsters spewing goo everywhere.
Yeah. And the other thing that it also accomplishes, which is a lot of books that have bands or music in them, there's a lot of very similar visuals, right, where it's like, okay, well, now they're holding the guitar like this and somebody's got their mouth open, they're singing. But like, when there's magic involved, we now again talking about like doing things to their absolute extreme, we now have a visualization of music going out and poking somebody in the eyes so that they get excited about what's happening, right? So like we've now taken music and heightened it again visually in a way that doesn't exist in a lot of other books, because it is magic, and it made things much easier.
Well, thank you both so much for coming to talk to us. This has been so much fun, and yeah, I hope everybody picks this book up and reads it, because I would love to see you know, this band tour a little bit more, get out there. So thank you so much for coming.
Well, I think we heard that it's inevitable.
It is inevitable. I'm going to put that out there. If Peter does show up, you know, to give me musical power, I will also ask for sequels.
Thank you, Jen. This was great.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Great. You're so welcome. Thank you. Okay, listeners, please pick up Black Cat Social Club. It is out near you now. Thank you so much for listening. It is now time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.